Hey everyone, it's officially fall. Nice weather, beautiful colors, but the other day I found myself in a scene from Blade Runner.
It's Wednesday, September 9th, and I, alongside everyone in San Francisco, woke up to this creepy, weird, orange glow in the air.
Yeah, it was surreal. So I literally started recording my thoughts.
I'm walking to grab lunch right now. It's about 2 o'clock. It's a little lighter, but it's orange outside. This is so nuts. It looks like there's just an Instagram filter, but of everything.
It almost looks like another planet. Ash covering and even piling up on cars.
Smoky orange haze that looks like dust or a movie on Mars or something.
Travelers just must be stunned when they're looking out those windows and seeing all that orange sky.
I gotta say, I enjoyed the change of scenery, but for a whole minute. Because I really started to worry.
So it looked exactly the same outside from 7 a.m. until now, which is about 4 p.m. Literally can't even tell what time it is. It's orange fog o'clock all day. Okay, it's now September 10th. The sky isn't as orange, but it's got this misty, foggy, smoky look to it. Kind of like it could be a really bad cloudy day, but if I take my mask off, it basically just smells like smoke and fire. The air quality actually feels worse today than yesterday.
All along the West Coast, dozens of large fires have caused evacuations, widespread destruction, and they're creating these gigantic plumes of smoke. So I took a step back and started to wonder, what's actually inside all the smoke we're seeing, and how does it really affect our air quality? What's it doing on the microscopic level when I breathe it in? What's it doing to my lungs? How does this affect the other issue, COVID-19? This is Nova Now, where we try to clear the air and find the science behind the headlines. I'm Alok Patel.
Support for Nova Now comes from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, dedicated to providing the latest therapies and cancer specialists who are experienced in your cancer. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
What's happening here in California, in some ways, isn't that unusual. Wildland fires happen every year, and they're essentially divided into two main categories: wildfires and prescribed fires. Wildfires can be started by lightning, lava, or by people doing things that they shouldn't do, like when you fail to put out a campfire or when you set off fireworks. Whereas prescribed fires are ignited after careful planning by local fire managers. Let me be clear, not all wildland fires are bad. There's a natural force out there. Sometimes they're needed to renew and balance ecosystems by getting rid of old brush, helping germinate the seeds of some plants, or providing important charred habitat for certain insects and small wildlife. But when they rage out of control, obviously, they can be deadly. And right now, we've seen a record-breaking amount of acres just scorched, generating vast clouds of smoke and air pollution.
Monday, September 14th. The air feels a little better. It looks a little better outside, but our AQI is still between 150 and 200, which is still not great.
AQI is the Air Quality Index. Think of it as a yardstick to measure air quality. It was made by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and it runs from 0 to 500. The higher the value, the higher the air pollution. The higher the air pollution, the higher the health concern. 0 is like crystal clear, pristine air with no pollution. And anything above 300 is just straight up labeled as hazardous. All right, to really understand these apocalyptic skies, I spoke with someone who's literally flown through them to find the answers. Her name is Emily Fisher.
I'm an associate professor of atmospheric science at Colorado State University.
She studies how air pollutants move in the atmosphere and how wildfire smoke impacts air quality. In 2018, you had this project called WECAN. And I'm like, this is awesome. Western Wildfire Experiment for Cloud Chemistry, Aerosol Absorption, and Nitrogen. I would just walk into bars and tell people that's what I did. But can you tell us about the WECAN project?
Sure. So in summer 2018, a large team instrumented the NSF NCAR C-130 aircraft.
That's a Lockheed C-130 Hercules, a gigantic American four-engine military transport aircraft, transformed in this case into a chemistry Skylab.
And we sampled the smoke from more than 20 different wildfires all across the West. So similar sized wildfires to those that are burning right now. Very large wildfires. Basically, what we did all summer was wake up in the morning, get the instruments ready. About 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we would head out to whatever wildfire was most active that day, starting basically as close as we could safely get to the fire source, and then tracking that same plume downwind and repeatedly sampling the chemistry of that plume. And we would take the plane and cross perpendicular in and out of the smoke, moving away from the wildfire. So it's like we were mowing the lawn with the airplane, taking samples to understand how the smoke chemical composition changed with time.
It sounds kind of scary, but what you were basically describing was how you and your team were in the C-130 and you actually were getting some smoke samples directly coming into the aircraft.
Yes, but the windows of the aircraft are not open, right? So most of the smoke is staying outside the aircraft, and we are very carefully sampling the outside air, pulling little bits of air in very quickly directly into different sets of instrumentation. So we would fly up to these fields of cumulus clouds, and then I would say, okay, pilots. And the pilots would just go cloud to cloud, like, and the whole back of the plane is like feeling like they're going to vomit. And I would medicate myself with one of those like scopolamine patches, right? So that I didn't throw up in the front. So I would just be like sitting there at the window being like, this is so awesome.
Emily Fisher's team conducted over a dozen smoke observation flights between July and August of 2018. It's one of the most comprehensive attempts so far to measure and analyze the wildfire smoke that can blanket vast areas of the country.
So basically, we were measuring carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen oxides, ammonia, nitric acid, acetyl nitrate,
and a bunch of other things like benzene, ozone, and toluene, a molecule used to make paints and adhesives, things that probably should not be in your lungs.
We'd do that for as many wildfires as we could that day.
I want to be an atmospheric scientist now.
My heart was racing a lot, and it's just, I think, because these fires are just so large and so powerful that it's like, it just feels wrong to be that close to them. It's like, what am I doing? Why am I flying into this thing where I can't see and it smells like a crazy campfire and, you know. And so basically, as soon as we would cross a smoke plume, I would be able to see carbon monoxide rocket up. In addition to visually knowing I was in a smoke plume because we can't see anything, you can also chemically see that rapid shift in air chemistry. But at the same time, you know it's safe, right? If the pilots are comfortable, they're not going to do something that they think is unsafe.
This is one of the most amazing commitments to meteorologic science. And based on this, can you tell us what exactly wildfire smoke is made of?
Right. Wildfire smoke is a combination of thousands of different gases and small fine particles that range in sizes. And the composition of those particles is mainly organic carbon, but there's all sorts of other trace constituents in there as well.
Mainly it has to do with what was burned by the particular fire in question. Trees, vegetation, houses, vehicles.
So the composition of smoke changes as you move downwind. So the smoke that you would be breathing if you were, say, right at a campfire or right downwind of a wildfire within hours is very different than the smoke that you're breathing if you were breathing smoke one day downwind or so. And so each chemical species lasts a different amount of time in the atmosphere.
But what about that Blade Runner orange sky?
When you have a really concentrated smoke plume, it's absorbing quite a bit of the sun's light and reflecting another portion of it. And so it's dark and your visibility is compromised. And then the fresher smoke tends to look more orange and more brown.
And that's exactly what we saw here in San Francisco a few weeks ago. It was a combination of atmospheric chemistry and physics right before our eyes. Smoke particles from the wildfires filter out certain wavelengths of sunlight. Pretty much they're absorbing or scattering the blue while letting some other colors come through, which can give skies that infernal, creepy color. It can also make the city darker and colder. Now, on the other hand, when fires are local, People see these massive smoke clouds, they think, oh my gosh, that's bad, and instantly it becomes news.
And you can smell it because it's local, and so the compounds that smell are still very much present in the smoke. And so people seem to be protecting themselves under those conditions, right? So as you move further downwind and smoke gets dilute, people can't smell the smoke, right? All the compounds that smell have reacted away.
It only takes a day for the chemicals in smoke that cause that smoky smell to react with other substances in the atmosphere, like ozone. And once those reactions take place, the smoke loses its smell. But this is tricky because odorless smoke is still dangerous. For example, benzene can stick around in the air for a day or two well after that smoky smell is gone. And benzene can actually cause cancer in humans with long-term exposure. So a little different than what's happening with wildfires, but it's still something that's terrible for your lungs. Other toxic compounds can also form when certain chemicals in the smoke start to break down. Now, at some point, the smoke becomes more diluted, and also this depends on how much someone is actually out there breathing.
They're not taking protective actions, or at least that's our hypothesis, when, you know, their noses aren't telling them to do so. You know, this morning I looked at the AQI and I made that determination for my family this morning. My kids are not allowed to go outside. We need to check the AQI. That's where we should be getting our information from, not from our noses right now.
I mean, you see reports of wildfire smoke from the West Coast getting over to the Midwest and the East Coast. You know, we see reports of wildfire smoke, you know, making it to Europe.
Right. So wildfire smoke, particularly from large Western U.S. wildfires, can travel very far. So it is routine for that smoke to cross the North American continent. There are regions that are more typically downwind of upwind fire regions. So, for example, you know, Colorado is often downwind of the Pacific Northwest or Northern California. Now, that smoke plume may not always be at the ground impacting air quality, but is somewhere in the atmospheric column. So for something to go all the way around the Northern Hemisphere at approximately the latitude of California, Oregon, Washington, at approximately that latitude, that's, you know, 3 to 4 weeks.
The impact reduces as you move further downwind because the smoke gets diluted, it reacts away, or it's rained out. Thank you, rain. Now, one of the compounds that Emily Fisher found in wildfire smoke is PM2.5. The PM stands for particulate matter, basically a mixture of solid particles and liquid droplets found in the air. Sometimes you can see some of those particles in dust, dirt, soot, or smoke, but other times they're so small, they can only be detected using an electron microscope. The 2.5 means these particles have a diameter that's generally 2.5 micrometers or smaller, which, to give you perspective, is a tiny fraction of the width of a single human hair. And these particles can go deep into your lungs and cause a lot of respiratory problems. That's physiology, which, as a doctor, is my jam, but we needed a specialist, so I phoned a friend. Do I have to call you Dr. Rutland? Can I just call you Jamie?
For sure.
All right. Cedric Jamie Rutland is a pulmonary and critical care physician in Southern California and a spokesperson for the American Lung Association. And sometimes I actually call him for life advice.
You know, my expertise in the pulmonary world is with autoimmune lung disorders or anything that causes inflammation in the lung that's just really not supposed to be there. So you can classify asthma as one of those, interstitial lung disease, things of that sort. I also do interventional pulmonary as well, just to keep my hands dirty, as well as running intensive care units just to keep my mind sharp. I've got a wife and two kids who are amazing. And, you know, that's it.
You know, I think it's funny because some people out there play solitaire or video games to quote unquote keep their mind sharp. But Dr. Rutland runs ICUs to keep his mind sharp. I just want that to sink in with everyone. Jamie spoke to me from his house where his two kids are running around. You can kind of hear them. It's adorable. Jamie, before we talk about things that don't belong in our lungs, such as smoke, you're in Southern California. How has the past couple weeks been? The wildfire smoke, how has that been for you and your patients?
You know, 2 weeks ago when I stepped outside, you can immediately smell the smoke. As soon as you smell the smoke, your body knows. Your eyes start to get irritated. They start to water. Your lungs are kind of like, wait, what is that? What's going on here? And I immediately look down, right? I'm looking at my kids and I'm like, do they feel this? Because that's when I got to make a U-turn and go back inside. It's obviously affecting patients and it does affect my practice because I do get a lot of phone calls on exacerbations of respiratory illnesses and allergic type of illnesses as well.
Now, we just talked to an atmospheric scientist about the particles that are actually in wildfire smoke, and we talked about organic carbon monoxide. But, you know, she also brought up things like benzene, toluene, ozone, and all these other byproducts. Can you speak to kind of what these molecules could do to our lungs and our short and long-term health?
So it's not supposed to be there. Your body recognizes it as foreign, and it increases the inflammatory products.
Inflammatory products is another way of saying our immune system sees something in your body that doesn't belong there. And then there's an attack, there's some cellular byproducts, and this all causes local inflammation.
And when you have an increase in inflammation in the lung, instead of being full of air, is full of white blood cells and full of reactive oxygen species.
When you think reactive oxygen species, skip the chemistry textbook. Just think chemical, it has oxygen, it can cause reactions. Sometimes those reactions can be good. Sometimes they can be really bad.
That also leads to more and more inflammation. So what ends up happening is significant harm in your lung. And the way that you feel that, you guys driving, you guys listening, is you're short of breath and you cough.
I understand that someone around the smoke, if you can see the smoke, it's in the air, you're near wildfire, could feel those effects right away. But what kind of health effects can you see if you're far away from the smoke and the air kind of has these pollutants in it, but you don't necessarily see it?
The most common health effects that you're going to see in those communities are the common health effects that we see in people who are living in industrialized areas. You're going to see the asthma exacerbations in the younger kids. You're going to see allergic type of symptoms. You're going to see cough. If you're a patient who smokes and has significant lung disease, you're going to feel it as soon as you step outside. You're going to be like, ooh, I'm not getting enough oxygen, or I don't feel like I'm getting enough air. The reason you're not getting enough air is because the air is full of other things other than nitrogen and oxygen like it's supposed to be full of, and that's an issue.
Fair. Okay, so when we hear these headlines, right, or these recommendations about, you know, going inside and protecting yourself from the harmful air, getting a HEPA filter, I think there's a bias there because some people don't have access to that, right? Like we have,
oh, man.
In California, large homeless community. There are people who don't necessarily have a chance to go to safe shelter or drive away. Can you talk about the disproportionate impact that we are seeing right now on poor air quality, air pollution, on different communities? And what message do we need to set out there? What can we do to collectively help people?
So here's what I notice. People can't afford to live where it's the most safe. People can't afford to live where the air is the cleanest. But what ends up happening, and this is interesting, policymakers will make it so diesel trucks can't drive through Beverly Hills, but they can drive through the industrialized areas in Seal Beach and Long Beach, right? So what happens is you have a concentration of air pollution in neighborhoods that are in these industrialized areas that leads to significant healthcare problems like asthma, like other types of lung diseases, right? And when you start to build up this pollution over the course of time, you're more likely to develop these issues. Not to mention the fact that these children and these adults are doing the same thing that other people are doing, like vaping, like smoking, which is further damaging their lung. So the disproportion continues because there's no access to healthcare there. Physicians aren't going there to educate the public on what's happening and what's going on and how to stay as healthy as they can. I'm not sitting here saying that everybody deserves to live off of Rodeo Drive. All I'm saying is that at some point, me, you, we got to go into that neighborhood and educate the children and educate the adults about what's actually happening and what their risk is.
To be honest with you, I consider myself savvy enough when it comes to social determinants of health and awareness, but I had no idea about that diesel truck kind of issue. I had another question for you. Have you seen anything recently, any links, any kind of exacerbations of COVID-19 symptoms with this wildfire smoke? I got a lot of questions from people saying, like, how do I tell the difference between the two?
Yeah, so listen, we already know that if you have COVID-19 and you smoke, you're going to do worse than somebody who doesn't smoke. And so when I think about air pollution, it's the same thing. We already know that air pollution can lead to worsening COVID-19. The studies are being done. We can't state exactly the prognosis or the relative risk or whatever it is for now, but we know that it affects it. So yeah, it makes it difficult. However, people that have smoke inhalation injury are next to the fires. Those are the people that most commonly present to the hospital or to the clinic. They're next to the fires. Now, the other thing you have to think about is as people flee these fires, where are they going? They're going inside. Well, who's inside? Other people. And so now they're exposing themselves to a greater number of people.
More people means more exposure to the virus.
So that's an issue.
I gotta say, I think 2020 has become the year of the face mask. Because, you know, we've been using masks in medicine for over 100 years. But this is the first time we've seen them dominate in the headlines. Here's director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Robert Redfield, at a Senate hearing last week.
These face masks are the most important, powerful public health tool we have. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine.
Masks are the center stage in the fight against the virus SARS-CoV-2, which causes the disease COVID-19. And they've also been the focal point of arguments that have started fights in grocery stores, airplanes, even aboard a New York City ferry. Give me a break. And lately, people are also thinking about them in the context of wildfire smoke.
The sun is blocked, the mountains are obscured, and the masks are now serving a dual purpose.
This is just making this worse with COVID. It's making the masks more imperative to be wearing right now than ever.
Now, granted, masks were old news in Asia way before the pandemic. We saw them become a central item in China's fight against air pollution, and especially in 2002, 2003, during the SARS outbreak. And that one, by the way, was successfully contained. But are they what we really need when it comes to dealing with wildfire smoke? To find out more, I talked to a couple of researchers at the School of Material Science and Engineering at Georgia Tech.
My name is Songmi Park.
My name is Sundare Sanjayaraman.
They're sort of modern versions of Inspector Gadget when it comes to integrating electronics and textiles. They're the co-creators of the Smart Shirt, the first wearable motherboard, created in 1996. It's basically a shirt made out of intelligent fabric that, get this, can monitor vital signs. It's so awesome, the shirt is now in the Smithsonian. Now, over the past decade, this dynamic duo, who sounds like they should be designing costumes for superheroes, have been studying face masks.
I was looking at some of those pictures, from the Bay Area, and it's so painful. And here we have these people who are fighting the fire, so we need to take care of those guys. But equally importantly, the poor citizens who are there, what kind of protection they need.
I have an engineering question to ask both of you. You know, I wear a mask almost every single day I'm at work, pre-pandemic, during the pandemic. And, you know, physicians and public health experts have been talking to everyone about the importance of masks right now and how they work. But I would love to hear from an engineering perspective about the difference in protection between an N95 versus a surgical mask versus a cloth mask.
The N95 is what you call the gold standard, right? As a physician, you know when you wear an N95, you get fit tested. Just be fitted to the individual who is wearing it. The fit test ensures that there is no leakage, either inward or outward leakage. And what the 95 tells you is it is going to filter out 95% of the particulates that are 0.3 microns and higher. So when you say N95, if you just go to Home Depot and pick up an N95, you are not going to have the 95% protection just because you have an N95, because it has not been fit tested.
So there's a little bit of confusion about the difference between an N95 and a KN95. It all comes down to where the mask was certified. Standard N95 masks are generally certified by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health here in the U.S., but they can be certified in other countries as well, whereas the KN95 are generally certified in China. Now, if you run out and just find any N95 mask or you pick one up at the store and you don't get professionally fitted, it'll still work, but it may not work as efficiently as it could because everyone's face is different. Dr. Jayaraman, I have to tell you a very quick, funny story. When I was a resident, I had to go get fit tested for my N95 mask. At the same time, I thought I would be cool, and I thought it was going to look good growing out a beard. I showed up to get fit tested, and they were like, you have to shave that beard right now. And Dr. Jayaraman's putting up a big X with his hands for our listeners. I shaved my beard in a bathroom at the testing place with a razor and water, no shaving cream.
Oh my God. Oh, no.
And so I had shaved this beard, but I also had a bunch of razor burn and bleeding and then did my fit test.
And then when Dr. Patel is not doing any kind of intubation or any kind of procedure that's going to generate an aerosol, he's going to be using a surgical mask. And what the surgical mask does is protects Dr. Patel's droplets from reaching his patients. it also provides some degree of protection to him.
In terms of a surgical mask, this has a very good filtration efficiency, but you can see there is a kind of opening on the side and also especially on top of the nose.
That's Sungmi Park, by the way. And that means surgical masks have very good filtration in the front, but not around it. Think of it like if you're holding an umbrella. You're going to protect yourself from rain coming straight down on top of you. But if it's raining sideways, you don't have full protection and your body's going to still get wet. I agree. I think the fit is, not only is it really important, I think it's underestimated. When people put on these masks and they don't understand that the air is flowing to the side, and people say, oh my God, why are my glasses fogging up when I wear a mask?
Exactly.
Like, because air is flying up through your nose. Can you give us a quick definition of filtration efficiency?
Let's say you've got 100 bad guys coming through, okay? And you put a barrier, and of that, only 3 guys can go inside. That means you have filtered out 97% of the bad guys. You can also think in terms of your typical strainer you might use in your kitchen, right? You're straining pasta, for instance. So what happens? You put it in your strainer. The big pieces stay inside the strainer, but the water goes down. But if any of your pasta pieces is broken down, that's also going through the sieve and it's going to come out. So that's how I would explain filtration efficiency, is how effective it is in terms of trapping the bad guys from either coming in or going out.
Understood. And right. Dr. Jayaraman, you know, when you mentioned a strainer in the kitchen, I was hoping you were going to use chai as an example rather than pasta, but that's okay.
And filtration is important. At the same time, breathability. You can have a higher filtration, but if you cannot breathe through it, then that's useless.
So Park and Jayaraman brought their engineering know-how to face masks and developed a breathable, comfortable, and washable design that limits leakage and is more effective from the viewpoint of filtration from your regular old, maybe artistic, cloth mask.
Our mask is made of a textile fabric.
Their redesigned mask is made of several pieces of fabric that are sewn together. It covers everything from above your nose to under your chin, almost going down to your neck. There's then panels of fabric that cover your cheeks, and there's a small opening for your ears. And the best part is it securely fastens behind the back of your head, which makes it stay in place. And it's reusable.
For a couple of reasons. One, an N95 cannot be washed. A surgical mask cannot be washed. Unfortunately, today, many people are reusing N95s, okay? Whereas our mask is intended for the general public.
It also features a pocket in the front where you can insert a filter if you want to level up your filtration efficiency, which is a good idea in protecting yourself against COVID-19.
It does not have the filtration efficiency of an N95, so it is not a respirator, it is not a surgical mask, it is a fabric or a cloth mask, but combines some of the features of the N95 by providing a good form fit so that you're able to prevent the bad guys from going out to others and from the bad guys from coming into you.
Now you're wondering, where can I get my very own Park Jayaraman mask? Well, it's not commercially available just yet, but you can make one yourself if you just check out the paper they wrote in the Journal of the Textile Institute. There's easy to follow instructions and there's photos. And pro tip, use multiple pieces of fabric so you can kind of win style points. Style matters. All right, that's face masks 101. But do they work?
In terms of protecting yourself from wildfire smoke?
Back to Dr. Jamie Rutland.
100%. N95 is the best mask to wear.
But people, please don't hoard them. They can be the difference between life and death for many healthcare workers and first responders.
Cloth masks don't work in wildfires. Other masks will work if you have nothing. Yeah, you're going to have to put a piece of cloth over your face, but just recognize that it's not doing much. When you go to the grocery store and you're buying paper towels and toilet paper, and you got to find at least a collection of N95 masks, whether it's KN95 or N95, especially if you're in a high-risk area like we are for the fires.
Like the entire West Coast is sadly a high-risk area, just a little nuts.
So to protect yourself, you have to do the same thing that we're doing with SARS-CoV-2. You have to stay inside. You have to wash your hands. You have to wear a mask when you're outside. You have to do all those necessary things to make certain that you don't expose yourself or cause damage to yourself when you don't really have to.
Jamie, thank you.
You're welcome.
For more information, go to lung.org, where there's loads of resources on wildfire safety as well as information on COVID-19. And if you want to explore dozens of other medical topics with Jamie, visit his YouTube channel, Medicine Deconstructed. If you have to deal with wildfire smoke, it's best to reduce your exposure, stay inside with windows and doors closed, and use a HEPA air filter if you can, especially if you have underlying medical conditions. And as always, listen to your local health officials and talk to your doctor about your own risk. Also, to get the air quality data where you live, go to airnow.gov or purpleair.com. Stay informed, people. Nova Now is a production of GBH and PRX. It's produced by Ian Koss, Ari Daniel, Jocelyn Gonzalez, Isabel Hibbard, Christina Monin, Sandra Lopez Monsalve, and Nina Porzuki.
I'm looking over the water on the Embarcadero towards Oakland, and it's blue skies. I can't believe it. Just 1 week ago, this place looked like a dystopian future. So I think we're in a good window right now. One thing that worries me is that we still have some more time left in fire season. So hopefully it stays like this for as long as possible.
Julia Court and Chris Schmidt are the co-executive producers of Nova. Dante Graves is director of audience development, Suki Bennett is digital editor, and Robin Kasmer is science editor. Sounds of the C-130 aircraft were provided by the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research. And our theme music is by the extremely hype and innovative DJ Kid Koala. I'm Alok Patel. We'll be back in 2 weeks, which is enough time for you to sew your very own Park Jayaraman face mask. And go wild with it. It's multiple pieces of fabric. I mean, you could go pink, blue, green, maybe some paisley, floral, houndstooth, herringbone, plaid, windowpane, shark skin, polka dot, gingham, glen check, I don't know, maybe graph check, madras, bengal stripe, awning stripe, bird's eye, candy stripe, pencil stripe, tartan. What?
From PRX.